بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على نبينا محمد وعليه وصحبه أجمعين. وإن شاء الله we'll have the second part of this talk إن شاء الله with Dr. Muhammad Mohr Ali, and إن شاء الله we will be having about 10 minutes of questions and answers, and إن شاء الله I'll give the chance إن شاء الله for Dr. Muhammad Ali to continue his talk. And please, brothers, as well as sisters, if you please write your question in a piece of paper. And I think they already distributed the slips for writing questions. And now I turn the microphone to Dr. Muhammad Mohr Ali for his talk, inshallah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Actually, before I start dealing with some of the points, because all the points cannot be covered in a series of lectures like this, I should like to point out to you, I am not self-advertising, but just giving you an information. The most of the things that I am going to speak or I have to speak, I have dealt with in my book, which he has mentioned. Because as you know, I have written two volumes on Siratul Nabi and the Orientalists. And these two volumes are published by the King Fahad Quran Printing Complex, Medina. These are the two volumes, Siratul Nabi. So those who are very serious students, especially those who are studying in the university level, SOAS or Cambridge University or Manchester University Oriental departments, I would ask them to please read the book. If you do not buy, it doesn't matter to me. The books are available in the library, most of the libraries, especially in the London University Library and in the British Museum Library. I am definitely available there, so you please read that. And another two books I have written, because this also relate to the subject. One is the Quran and the Orientalists, the latest assumption, especially about Toby Lester's article, which I replied to. And the other is Quran and the Orientalists, a small but a revised version. Here is the book. I think these two books are also available here, especially with the GMAS people there. I think they have already started marketing it. So please have a copy of it and go through it. So you will find the ways of dealing with the Orientalists, the ways of replying to the Orientalist attacks. I say this, and I emphasize it time and again, that this is not a one man's job. I have started only a little bit. I earnestly request you, especially the young men, the university graduates, undergraduates, to carry the work on. One thing is certain, the Orientalists have now established a halo around them. A sort of complex they have created, even among the Muslim scholars, Muslim students. In our part of the world, in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, even in China, even in Indonesia, I find many young men, they're saying that, oh, Orientalists, they are great scholars, so they cannot be replied to. They are very thorough men. They are very thorough. But this myth, this legend, that they are inassailable, they are infallible, that myth must be crushed. That myth you should not accept, it should be rejected. They are human beings, and they are susceptible to faults and mistakes, and they are mistaken in almost all the points. One person asked me, do you think that there is a mustashiq adil munsif? If there is any just an impartial mustashriq, impartial Orientalist? My reply is this, that the question is irrelevant. If there is a case before a court, there are, you know, lawyers and counsels on both sides. On one side, the accused may be supported, there is a defendant. On defendant's side and on the litigant's side. You cannot say whether one advocate is just and another advocate is unjust. You have to accept that here is an advocate for a cause, and there is another advocate for another cause. The Orientalists are advocates for their cause. So the question of their being just does not arise. Just arises only with reference to the judge, the Hakim. But they are not the Hakim. So how can I say that an Orientalist is just Orientalist? He cannot, by the very fact of his being an Orientalist, cannot be just. Cannot be just. He has to advocate his cause. He is an advocate. I am an advocate of Islam. So to the Christian missionary, I cannot be a just. And to me as a Muslim, an Orientalist cannot be a just. He belongs to one party, I belong to another party. That's all. I am not saying that he is a bad man, he is an unjust man. He is an advocate. So don't think that Orientalists are inassailable, they are infallible. The myth must be crushed. When I started this writing, you know, there was a vice chancellor of a university who was a very close friend of mine. He said, you do not do this because you will be bogged down into apology. He cannot reply to them. They are very sound scholars. Another person who is still working in Makkah, he said, oh, are you going to attack Montgomery Watt, a great professor of Harvard University? But yes, a great professor of Harvard University. What about that? A great professor can commit a great mistake. So why should I not point out that mistake? That is how you approach. I am not showing my importance, or I am not showing any pride in this. I am just trying to encourage you young people, because you young people are to carry the banner. We are old enough and we cannot do. We have done our bit. Now it is for you to take forward. And in this country, while you are staying here, dawa work means replying to the criticism of the unbelievers, of the Christian missionaries, of the Orientalists. And that is very much important in this country. No dawa work can be effectively done in this part of the world unless you have full-fledged knowledge of the tactics, the arguments, the allegations of the Orientalists, and you are well equipped with the answers and with the criticism. That is what you should do, everyone should do, whether you are an engineer, whether you are a school teacher, or whether you are an ordinary dai. So that is your duty. Now let me come to the more specific points. I have said that at every stage, everywhere, there is the Orientalist attack, beginning from the sources, Abrahamic tradition. I cannot take one by one deal with them. I give one example, which is very much important in this present world context. The so-called economic interpretation of Islam, economic interpretation of the rise of Islam. How Islam came into being? Because this economic interpretation of history or world developments that has assumed a great importance because of the socialistic movement or socialism, because of the coming of socialism, Marxism, from the beginning of the 20th century, this has become a fad with all the historians to write anything about any development, tracing it to the economic ground, socio-economic factors. So Islam or the life of the Prophet has suffered from that fad of the Orientalists. And I give you just an indication of how it developed. The first person to write about the economic interpretation of Islam was Hubert Grimm, G-R-I-M-M-E, Grimm or Grimm. He, in his Life of the Prophet, he wrote that Islam is nothing but, it is another phase of the struggle between the haves and the have-nots. You know the meaning. Islam is a struggle between the poor and the rich people. And in Mecca there was a group of poor people, and there was a group of rich people. Everywhere there are groups of poor people. And but Islam came into being just for the sake of the benefit of the poor people, and this is because Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, he spoke about the interest of the miskin, of the orphans. You know about these orphans and miskin and zakah, all these things. So it was nothing but a compromise between the old Arabian religion and so this system. The second thing they did, they know that Arabia, and specifically the Quraysh at Mecca, they were trading people, they were traders, they were merchants. And it is well known in history. So a double sort of theory was developed by Richard Bell, who was a professor at the Edinburgh University, and his student, another professor, Montgomery Watt, they gave a twofold interpretation of the coming of Islam, economic interpretation. One is that the Quraysh tribes, especially Banu Hashim, Banu Asad, Banu Makhzum, Banu Umayyah, they were great trade rivals. So that the Prophet was ousted from the, in his boyhood and in his youth, in his adolescence, he was ousted from the most profitable international trade, which is incorrect, which is a false lie. And because in order to regain his position in the field of international commerce, the Prophet came forward with this movement. This is one view. And the second and more sophisticated but very cleverly formulated view is that Makkah was emerging as a commercial city. All Arabia is nomad. There are nomads and Bedouins. So that there was in the first half of the 7th century, during the time of the Prophet when he was coming, we see the spectacle of the emergence of Mecca from nomadism into commercialism. You see how high sounding words, very grandiloquent phrases signifying nothing, these are used by the Orientalists. From commerce merchant, from nomadism, Mecca was emerging into commercialism and capitalism. And this needed adjustment of the society and the basis of the society, the religious system. And what Muhammad did was to make an adjustment of nomadism with commercialism. He retained the old source of wealth, old source of commerce, because Mecca was the head of the, was at the Kaaba, everybody came for Hajj and trade at Kaaba. So the old original Hajj system and the visiting of Mecca, all these things had to be retained. But idolatry had become old fashioned, especially with the lands of Syria, Lebanon, where Muhammad and others visited for trade purposes. There were Christianity, so they were impressed by Christianity and Tawheed, one God. So he imported the idea of one God from Syria, especially from the markets where he visited. He came back here, but he could not destroy the basis of the old trade, the commerce, Makkah's trade, the Kaaba. So he made an amalgam between the two and made this Islamic religion. And the third is still the same factor. Third is that he had to get the support of the poor people. So that his converts were all, or mostly they were poor men, slaves, and they came from the lowest strata of the society. Now this argument is placed very seriously in well published and important books published by the Oxford University, published by the Cambridge University, Grimes' theory, and also C.H. Baker's theory about the struggle between the have and the have-nots. This has been published in the Cambridge Medieval History, published by the Cambridge University Press. Bell's theory and Watt's theory, that has been published in the Life of Muhammad by Montgomery Watt, which is known as Muhammad at Mecca, Muhammad at Medina. There are two volumes. So these are read by all the students all over the world. Not perhaps in the Arab world, because they do not study Arab English books. They still abide by their own textbooks. But I, as a student, when I was an honors student, the honors student in Dhaka University in 1949, long ago, it is more than half a century ago, I was given the book of William Muir to read, and the Cambridge Medieval History. I almost committed to memory this chapter, the economic interpretation of history, and even in this class work, I was given the tutorial work to write an essay on the Arab expansion and the economic interpretation of the rise of Islam. So I had to study all these theories at that time. And subsequently, I recommended all these books to my students, and my students, they are also recommending these students. And I can assure you that these books are still read not only in Bangladesh but also in Pakistan, which I have visited, in India, which I have found these books are studied, and similar books I have also found studied in the Far East, in China, in the Chinese universities, they are translating all these books. So this is not simply a simple matter that we may just laugh at it. This is a very simple and a very faulty and ridiculous expression, but this expression is being given seriously, widely and systematically by the universities and by the research organizations and academic bodies. So we have to take it seriously. Unfortunately, nobody has ever written against this theme. Humbly I may say I have written. In Dhaka University as a student I protested against this theme, and as a teacher I have continued to this, and I gave you one or two simple examples of this. How to deal with this? I have not all the answers, but I have some points that you can elaborate on them. And I give you hints to work, how you will work. You know, the question of emergence of commercialism, emergence of Makka from nomadism to commercialism, is a historical nonsense. And nobody has pointed out it. Because the Arabs were a trading nation, not simply in the 7th century. The Arabs were a trading nation right from the beginning, from the Roman times. Even during the Roman times, the Arabs used to carry on trade and commerce. Even during the time of and Al-Hijr, and even during the time of Yusuf alayhi salam. You understand? You know the story of Yusuf alayhi salam. What happened when his brothers threw him into the well? He ghayabat al-jub. He was thrown. And who brought him out? A caravan, a trade caravan. Where did they come from? From America? From Japan? or from India? They came from east of Arabia, from the land of Arabia, and they were the Ismailite traders going to Egypt through the land, through Palestine, through that land, and they found him out. So the trade caravan was going there. And now this is an information not only in the Quran. This is an information in the Bible. So according to the Bible, there was a trade route from Yemen to Egypt to Syria through Makkah, through Taif, and through Khaib, Hajar, Asa, and Khaybar. This was a route. And this route even was there during the time of the Lut alayhi salam, of Saleh alayhi salam. This was the truth. There is a innahuma la bi imamin mubin. Innahuma, the two cities, yes. The cities of Ashabul Aika, yes. the people of Khaybar, and the other city, the Lut city. These were on the imamin mubin, the great trade route. So when the Orientalists say that that Makkah came into being as a commercial city in the 7th century, early 7th century, do you have historical record only for that? Makkah was a commercial city right from the beginning of history. We know that from the Christian sources, from the biblical sources, from the Quran, from Greek sources. So how do you deny that? It was not a new phase. So how very faulty, how very wrong is the assumption that Makkah was coming into being as a commercial city only in the 7th century AD? No, that is not correct. So if the premise is not correct, how do you say that it was emerging from nomadism? Now, second thing is that in ancient societies, everywhere we find, if you go into the sociological interpretation of ancient history, so you will find that nomadism and urbanism, settled people and unsettled people, these two phases of sociological development we notice in every phase of history in every country. Even now in England there are nomads. Even in Europe there are nomads. In Arabia, nomads and settled people, Badawi and Hadar, these existed from time immemorial. All the important tribes of Khaybar, the Jewish tribes of Khaybar, Aus and Khazraj in Makkah, Medina, Banu Saqif in Taif, Banu Amir in Eastern Arabia, the Quraysh, Banu Jarhum and Quraysh, they were all settled people in the great oasis towns of Makkah, Khaybar, Medina or Yathrib and Eastern Arabia. They were the settled people. And there are places in Arabia where the nomads roamed from place to place. And that phase is going on from time immemorial. So there was no such thing in Arabia that the nomadic people gradually transformed themselves into settled people, became commercial people and became traders. That is a faulty theory, that is a generalized theory, which these European scholars have imposed on the history of Arabia. Arabia, even in India, even in England, even in America, nomads and settled peoples are staying and living side by side, even in Central Asia, in Mongolia, in China. These phases are there, Bedouins and the settled people. Sorry. So, the very basis of this theory is wrong. Why don't you point out this? Yes, Professor, you are saying this. When did Makkah come into being? Makkah came into being long as a commercial city long before that. What about Abraha? He attacked Medina. Why? To destroy its Kaaba. Why? Because that was attracting all the trade. When did it happen? When did it happen? Before the birth of the Prophet. In that very year actually Prophet was born. Don't you know? So when Abraha found that Makkah was a great commercial rival to Sana'a, to Yemen, Makkah was not just emerging into the commercial scene, it was a great flourishing city, commercial city, and it took hundreds of years to be so. And we know who did bring about the commercial greatness of Makkah. It was the Prophet's great grandfather Hashim, who concluded a number of treaties with Syria, with the neighboring tribes, to establish trade relations for the Quraysh people in Makkah. So when did it happen? Hashim lived about 100 years before Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So it was about 100, one century before. So why are you telling that Makkah in the first half of the or first quarter of the 7th century was emerging from nomadism to commercialism, and then this commercial Prophet effected a solution to that anomaly between the social situation there and the commercial situation. This is just a faulty analysis of history, and you should look into the matter carefully and conclusively. Now give me a reply. If there is anybody, I challenge anybody to say that Makkah was only commercial city only in the first half of the 7th century. Is it a valid question? It is not valid. There is no valid basis for it. Now, there is another way we can approach this. How did the Prophet bring about a solution of commercialism and nomadism and capitalism? The most important thing is that Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam did not tolerate capitalism. And the best example is that the making usury, this interest system, haram. He could not have done so, and he would not have done so, if he looked only to the interest of the commercial men in Makkah. Because they were also dealing with the Jews, and according to some tradition, some of the Arabs, some of the people of Quraysh also lent money on interest. In fact, Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when this ayah came for making interest unlawful, he said that if it is possible, you just take your capital, don't take the interest. He said so, and that is well known to history. That is well known. Could any man who was supporting capitalism and working for effecting a solution between the rising commercialism and capitalism with the nomadic society, could he have ever thought of illegalizing interest at such commercial dealings? He could not have. So what nonsense you are speaking that he made. And now, on top of everything, if he wanted to make an adjustment between commercialism and nomadism, and if that was the need of the hour, and they say it was the need of the hour, some sort of adjustment had to be made, in order to keep the society intact, in order to keep the economy running. If that was the question, and you know, if it is the need of the hour, a society is like a living organism. It adjusts to the situations and needs of the time, and it does not reject what is natural. If an adjustment of commercialism with nomadism, with commercial economy and nomadic economy was necessary, it became a need of the hour, then the Prophet's reforms and his rules and regulations would have been very much acceptable to the commercial elite of Makkah. They would have welcomed. Now, as this is, if you lower the interest rate, it is for the interest of the commercial interest here. If you raise it, it is for the commercial. They accept it. But did the Quraysh elite, commercial elite, accept it? Why did he have to flee from Makkah? They did not accept him. So he did not do anything which was required for the time. If it was a solution of the need of the time, he would have been very much welcome and accepted by the Makkan commercial society at that time. But what history says? What does the Makkan period teaches us? The Quraysh leaders, the commercial elite, Banu Makhzum, Abu Sufyan, Abu Lahab, Abu Jahal, all these leaders, big leaders, they came unitedly against the reforms made by Rasulullah ﷺ, and ultimately he had to flee the country with his followers, about 100 followers, he had to go to Medina. So, the commercial adjustment of which you are so grandiloquently and so vociferously, so loudly speaking, this was not there. It is a figment of your own imagination. I dealt with all these questions, I have dealt with in this book, in this fashion. It is not seerah, it is common sense, it is common knowledge of history that you have to apply and you have to take into account in order to deal with this question, because you have to approach the criticism of the Christians, criticism of the Orientalists, from a wider angle, just by not reading. I do not say you do not. You have to read Hadith, you have to read the Quran, you have to read the Tafaseer, you have the Seerah, but you have to have a knowledge, a wider knowledge of general history, of something of economics, something of theories, etc., in order to meet the criticisms, some sorts of philosophy to meet the criticism of the Orientalists. That is what is required. And when I have shown this to some of the Orientalist scholars, then, oh yes, that is right, this theory is, perhaps it is not correct, because Makkah was always a commercial city, nomadism and commercialism, even after the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, about 1,500 years have elapsed. Has Makkah emerged only commercially? All the Arabia has emerged commercially, or there are the Bedouins still there? There are Bedouins there, but there are great commercial magnates there in Arabia. There are Al-Razihis, there are Zamzums, but there are also poor people, poor Bedouins there. Why has not been the Bedouins or nomadism eliminated? Because it cannot be. It is a process. It is a social system. There are different factors. So you should not theorize like this. I do not like to go further into that economic aspect, because this might be sounding very dry to you, because it is not Quran and Hadith. I come to a very small point. How many minutes left?
Ten
minutes. Then they will be putting questions. I come to a very, very ordinary subject. The Christian, the Orientalists say that Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he was not an illiterate person. We know that he was unlettered or illiterate. Illiterate is a very harsh term, but let me use it. He was not an illiterate or unlettered person, and you know, especially Richard Bell, the Edinburgh University professor, and his pupil Montgomery Watt, and after them some others, including even one Indian professor, they support the theory that Muslims, in order to prove that the Quran is a miracle, they have invented the story that the Prophet, their Prophet, was an unlettered person. But that is not correct. He knew reading and writing, but that has been suppressed by the Muslims. And he knew reading, at least reading and writing, to transact commercial business, keep commercial records, because he used to go on commerce, carry out some trade and commerce. So, and their argument is that they have employed, I tell you how, they have used the Islami, the Quran and the Hadith, all the sources, and their only maneuver, their method, is to misinterpret and to misrepresent, because they have no other stock in trade. They have to misinterpret the Quran and they have to misinterpret the facts, because the truth is on our side, and truth always shines. قُلْ جَعَ الْحَقُّ وَزَحَقَّ الْبَاطِلِ. But they want to suppress the truth. يُتْفِرُنَ نُورَ اللَّهِ بِأَفْوَاهِهِمْ. They want to do that. Now how they have done this? One argument they place is that Makkah was a trading society. Reading and writing was known to them. There were poets, great poets composing poems. There were competitions for poetry making. These poems were hung up in the Kaaba wall. So they were a literate people. They were very much involved. Waraka ibn Nawfal, he was a greatly learned man. So was Al-Huayris. Ibn Huayris. He was of Banu Asad. He was a learned man. So many persons were learned. So it is a common knowledge that people were very much learned at that time, and they knew reading and writing. So there is a presumption, they call it a presumption, that Muhammad knew some sort of writing and reading, especially in order to transact business. Of course, that is a general argument. Specifically, the Orientalists are confronted with some of the very positive evidence contrary to their conclusions. So they have to misinterpret. And in the Quran, specifically, there are references that the Prophet did not know reading and writing. And do you know where is that reference? Number one is, he is called Ummi. وَالَّذِي بَعَثَ فِي الْأُمِّيِّينَ رَسُولًا مِّنْكُمْ. And Ummi. And you know, Ummi is generally interpreted as a man without formal education, reading and writing, he did not know. That is one thing. And the other thing in the Quran, the very positive reference to the Quran, in the Quran about the Rasul Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, this is, I think, Surah An-Kabut, Ayah 48, everybody knows that. وَمَا كُنْتَ تَتْلُو مِنْ قَبْلِهِ مِنْ كِتَابٍ وَلَا تَخُطُّهُ بِيَمِينِكَ إِذَا الْأَرْتَابَ الْمُبْتِلُونَ. You were not used to reading any book. وَمَا كُنْتَ تَتْلُو. كُنْتَ, it means past continuous using. You were not used to, you did not used to write, read تَتْلُو مِنْ قَبْلِهِ, before this, كِتَابٍ, any book. Now you see, Kitabin. You did not used to recite or read any book from the any book before it. Now Kitabin is Wahid. It is singular number. Nakira, indefinite. You see that. وَمَا كُنْتَ تَتْلُو مِنْ قَبْلِهِ مِنْ كِتَابٍ وَلَا تَخُطُّهُ بِيَمِينِكَ. Not did your right hand, you did not write it with your right hand. إِذَا الْأَرْتَابَ الْمُبْتِلُونَ. Or else, in that case, if you did so, then these prattlers, the unbelievers, they could have entertained some doubts about you. Now this ayah is a very positive proof that sallallahu alaihi wasallam did not know reading and writing, at least before the nuzul of the Quran. That is certain. The Quran is very much specific. Now the Orientalists, Baal and what? What he has done? He has said, no, this is not the meaning given by the Muslims. The meaning is that Kitab referred to the Bible or Torah and Injil. Muhammad did not read any Bible. The Kitab means the Bible. he did not read any Bible. And somebody else might have read for him. Probably Waraka ibn Nawfal read to him. It is a very, very ridiculous argument. If somebody else wrote, that does not mean. The Quran is saying that he did not read any book. Kitabin. And they are now befooling their students, their readers, because most of the readers, these books are for the non-Arabs, those who do not know Arabic, because their books are not read by the Arabs, English books, and the non-Arabs do not know the difference meaning. So, Kitab is Nakira, Wafid, any book. Al-Kitab means the book, and in the Quran, the Bible or the Torah, and even the Quran, that has always been referred to as Al-Kitab. Al-Kitab, the book. And
Min Kitab.
Min Kitab is any book. So, Min, number one, and the Nakira and Wahid is number two, any book. Where the Quran says any book, the Orientalists are interpreting it as the book. He did not read the book, I mean the Bible, and that is why he made so many mistakes about crucifixion. He made so many mistakes about Trinity, about Uzair, all these things. So this is one thing. Now the other thing is this, most important, the other ayah, that is Surah Al-Furqan, which gives another very insight into this matter, besides the term Ummi. وَقَالَ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا إِنْ هَذَا إِلَّا يَفْكُنِ افْتَرَاهُ وَأَعَانَهُ عَلَيْهِ قَوْمٌ آخَرُونَ فَقَدْ جَاءُوا ظُلْمًا وَزُورًا وَقَالَ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا those who disbelieve, they say, إِنْ هَذَا إِلَّا يَفْكُنِ this Quran is nothing but a fabrication. إِفْكُنْ افْتَرَاهُ he has fabricated. أَعَانَهُ وَأَعَانَهُ عَلَيْهِ and there has assisted him on it قَوْمٌ آخَرُونَ another people. Now, and they quote this ayah, especially Montgomery Watt and Bell, they quote this ayah and saying, the Quran says that there are the kafirs, the Makkan Quraysh, used to allege that the Muhammad has fabricated the Quran. And since Makkan Quraysh alleged it, they are his contemporary. They knew him well. So Muhammad must have done this. The Quran says that it is. Now how they are misinterpreting it. This is a reply to the allegation of the Makkan Quraysh. They say, وَقَالَ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا they say, it is their saying, but and the Orientalists say, the Quran has not given any reference to, any reply to this, and they have not denied it. It says only that the kafirs used to say. But that is not the thing. Now, the second part of the ayah, they do not translate, they do not quote it in their writing. They quote it in Arabic, the whole thing, وَقَالَ اللَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا إِنْ هَذَا إِفْكُنْ إِفْتَرَاهُ وَآَانَهُ عَلَيْهِ قَوْمٌ آخَرُونَ Stop. The other part of the ayah is, فَقَدْ جَاءُ ذُلْمًا ذُورًا But indeed, they have done an injustice and come up with a fabrication and a false allegation. This part, they keep withheld from their readers and interpret it in a different way. Now, that is one thing, they are misinterpreting, deceiving their readers, but then they are not following their own leaders, own arguments. Now, we have to point out two or three very important things. If you think very cleverly and clearly. Now say, right, the Quraysh, the Kafir said, "In Hada, this is a fabrication, which he had made, fabricated with the help of other people who helped him." Now, the question is, number one thing, think very clearly and very logically, number one thing, I am wanting to become a leader. I am wanting to write a book. And now I take up your help writing from some of you, and then I produce a book and I say, this is a book you must follow. Now, would you accept it? Would you say that I have written it, or you will expose me? You will say, no, you have taken this information from me, you have taken this information from me. How do you say that you have produced the thesis? This is our information. You have made the plagiarism. You have committed a theft, an intellectual robbery. Would you not say like that? But Then, second thing, the Prophet ﷺ did not conceal his nubuwah, prophethood. He claimed or he gave out himself to be a prophet, and that involved the leadership of the whole community, of the whole mankind. He was becoming a leader, he was claiming a leader, he was claiming to guide them. And then if he received information and ideas from others, will those others follow him or will expose him? Is there any story, is there any event in the history of Islam that any of the followers of the Prophet and the early Muslims say that, look Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, look Muhammad, you have taken this idea from me and you are claiming himself to be a Prophet and composing the Quran, the idea is mine. Did anybody say so? No. So this is a logic. So he could not have taken any help from anybody. Now the second point is that the kafirs, they said, another group of people helped him. Why did they say so? Another group of people helped him. Because, if you think deeply, because they knew that Muhammad, as Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, was incapable of producing a text which appeared to be there to them to be a sihr, a magic. It was such a text which was unusual, unthought of, and which could not be made by any ordinary man. And they themselves said that in haza illa sihr mubin. What is this sihr? Sihr means magic. Did the Prophet carry out and show them any magic or any miracle as such? The only miracle they showed was the Quran. And the Quraysh, knowingly or unknowingly, they admitted that it is a magic. And then they said, he could not have himself made this. That means they knew that Prophet was illiterate, incapable of writing this, so he has taken the support of this. So the very logic which the Orientalists apply, that logic, apart from their misinterpretation, raises more questions than solve them. Because they raise why the general people would go to support the Prophet, give him information about Bible, about the Torah, about the Injil, about Christianity and other things, and then the Prophet would sit in his chamber, and in the night he will think about it and give it as a revelation. It is humanly impossible, it is logically irrational. It cannot be so. Even if he took it, he would have been exposed. And in fact, the Quraysh leaders, when they made this allegation in the second ayah, وَقَالُوا أَسَاطِرُ الْأَوَّلِينَ اِكْتَتَبَهَا فَهِيَ تُمْلَى عَلَيْهِ بُكْرَةً وَاسِلًا. Old stories, he has got these written and read out to him in the morning and the evening. That is because the implication is he could not read. He needed others to read out. And then he gave it out as a revelation. Good, quite good. So if he got it written for others and read out, he could not read. And the Quraysh leaders, while making this, there is another point to be very clearly remembered. You have to go deep into the detail. Just exercise your brain. A group of people controlling the whole city, Quraysh leaders, Makkah was not a very big city at that time. Everybody knew everyone. All the neighbors were known, especially the leaders, Makkan leaders. They knew the nook and corner of Makkah at every time. And they knew that some of the Christian slaves and Christian traders, they have become Muslims, followers of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. That is why they say that some of the people, this Christianity has given them. But they did not stop there. They persecuted Bilal and others and everybody. And everybody they inquired, did you teach Muhammad something? Did you teach Muhammad something? And they persecuted a number of people. Did you tell Muhammad about this story, about Yusuf's story, about the story of the Torah? Did you say so? And one of the slaves who became Jabr radiallahu ta'ala anhu. And it is mentioned in Tafsir al-Qurtubi. If you see this Tafsir to this ayat, then you will find it is mentioned that they persecuted a number of persons. They beat him and they kept him in the sun. And one of these slaves, Jabr radiallahu ta'ala anhu, he gave out, he saying, when he was persecuted too much, he said, look, you are telling that I have taught him. It is not I who teaches him. It is he who teaches me and guides me. It is he, Muhammad, who teaches me and he guides me. And you are saying that I taught him and I guided him. So look the point. So what the orientalists are saying, it is not true. It is not logical. It is not historical. Because there were men and the Quraysh leaders were no fools. They were very much intelligent and they got hold of so many people and they persecuted. But nobody said that I have taught him. So in this way, I am not going into the orientalist meaning of the Ummiyun they have put because there is no time. But this is the lines of argument you have to apply. Saying that the orientalists, they are not infallible. And if you reply to them logically, rationally, factually, I think many of them will be convinced. At least the very brunt of their attacks will cease because they are also human beings. And I have great respect for the intellectualism of the orientalists. They are good advocates, but I find fault with their advocates. I do not disrespect them. I disagree with them. So don't hold them to be gods. They are fallible, they are questionable, they are refutable. That is what you have to remember. Thank you very much. And now the time is for questions. I prayer for also. So,
طيب جزاكallah خير Dr. Muhammad Moradi for this very interesting lecture. May Allah reward you for
thank
that.
You
and inshallah, this really it opens our minds for really many things that we need to
think about it,
and it, at least it gives us the keys to refute, okay, the orientalist and to move forward.